Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to our study of Christianity for Modern Pagans. We're in the chapter, The Vanity of Dogmatism, and we had gotten about halfway through the lengthy pensée that begins on page 107. Oh, excuse me, not even halfway. We had gotten into page 108. I'm going to do a running start just by jumping into the first part of this pensée, 131. By the time we get to the third or so paragraph on page 108, we'll be into the new material and we'll start referring to Crafe's notes as well. So this chapter, The Vanity of Dogmatism, again, this certainty, this very narrow and absolute certainty that is rendered impossible by skepticism, and in and of itself would be a kind of denial of God, ultimately, philosophically anyway. So we're going to be spending most of our time there, and if we have time, we'll go into Vanity of the Philosophers, 115 and following. Let's begin with our invocation prayer. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Okay, page 107, pensée 131. The strongest of the skeptics' arguments, to say nothing of minor points, is that we cannot be sure that these principles are true, faith and revelation apart, except through some natural intuition. Now, this natural intuition affords no convincing proof that they are true. There is no certainty apart from faith as to whether man was created by a good God, an evil demon, or just by chance. And so it is a matter of doubt, depending on our origin, whether these innate principles are true, false, or uncertain. Moreover, no one can be sure, apart from faith, whether he is sleeping or waking, because when we are asleep, we are just as firmly convinced that we are awake as we are now. And we often dream we are dreaming, piling up one dream on another. Is it not possible that this half of our life is itself just a dream, onto which the others are grafted and from which we shall awake when we die? That while it lasts, we are as little in possession of the principles of truth and goodness as during normal sleep. And who can doubt that if we dreamed in the company of others and our dreams happened to agree, which is common enough, and if we were alone when awake, we should think things had been turned upside down. I pause at the dogmatist's only strong point, which is that we cannot doubt natural principles if we speak sincerely and in all good faith. To which the skeptics reply in a word that uncertainty as to our origin entails uncertainty as to our nature. The dogmatists have been trying to answer that ever since the world began. This means open war between men, in which everyone is obliged to take sides either with the dogmatists or with the skeptics, because anyone who imagines he can stay neutral is a skeptic par excellence. This neutrality is the essence of their clique. Anyone who is not against them is their staunch supporter, and that is where their advantage appears. They are not even for themselves. They are neutral, indifferent, suspending judgment on everything, including themselves. Okay, and here, since that was the new paragraph, we'll jump over to Crafe's comment F, which is probably on page 112. Yes, top of 112. Crafe says the consistent skeptic is skeptical of everything, including his own skepticism. If not, he is refuted. My, how dogmatic you are about your skepticism. So we talked last week about the silence that all of this creates, and that's like skepticism ultimately leads to a kind of silence, a kind of indifferentism, if it's honest in any case. All right, let's pick back up with the Pensée on 108. What then is man to do in this state of affairs? Is he to doubt everything? To doubt whether he is awake, whether he is being pinched or burned? Is he to doubt whether he is doubting? To doubt whether he exists? No one can go that far, and I maintain that a perfectly genuine skeptic has never existed. Nature backs up helpless reason and stops it going so wildly astray. Okay, I don't know, there's a second D here, so we're going to carry on. I don't know if it's a typo or what. Is he, on the other hand, to say that he is the certain possessor of truth, when at the slightest pressure he fails to prove his claim and is compelled to lose his grasp? So, now on to G, it's a short one. As soon as there is a dogmatist, the skeptic wins, just as soon as there is a balloon, the pin wins. All right. What sort of freak then is this man? The Pensée continues. How novel, how monstrous, how chaotic, how paradoxical, how prodigious. Judge of all things, feeble earthworm, repository of truth, sink of doubt and error, glory and refuse of the universe. What a great paragraph. Who will unravel such a tangle? This is certainly beyond dogmatism and skepticism, beyond all human philosophy. Man transcends man. Let us then concede to the skeptics what they have so often proclaimed, that truth lies beyond our scope and in an obtainable quarry, that it is no earthly denizen, but at home in heaven, lying in the lap of God. You cannot be a skeptic without stifling nature. You cannot be a dogmatist without turning your back on reason. And here we'll go grab a couple of comments, both H and I, on page 112. Why does Pascal tie us in knots, circles, and inescapable dilemmas like this? To show us this terrific truth about ourselves, a truth we hide from, the truth that we are two incredible, paradoxical extremes, judge and worm, glory and garbage. And to show us that no human philosophy can unravel this riddle. To put us in the market for listening to God, that is destroying the pretensions of proud, chattering reason to create silence. For only in silence can God's word be heard. Now, it would be more obvious to you if you didn't have all my commentary and you were reading this straight through, but that was one of the earliest points in this text, is that the role of apologetics in the pagan age is to create silence so that the voice of God can be heard. And so this is the whole reason why we're pursuing the vanity of dogmatism, I mean, which of course part of that is the vanity of skepticism, the vanity of reason, and that is to create the silence in which God speaks and grants that which our own reason can't grant. That the only way to have any kind of grounding in certainty is not apart from God, like the dogmatists, but in God, which is in effect contrary to both dogmatists and skepticists, but wonderfully and paradoxically is something they could both agree to. Okay, on to comment I. Here is the unsolvable dilemma. We cannot deny reason without contradicting ourselves and invalidating our very denial. And we cannot deny our nature because we are our nature. If we deny our reason, we must use our reason to do so. And if we deny our nature, we must use our nature to do so. Yet our reason and our nature contradict each other. Our reason insists on doubt. Our nature insists on certainty. So you can think about that, like if you're tracking with the rationality and the reason, the reasoning that's been set forward, like the reason why, even if you just think of the infinite regression, the reason why you would claim to know anything without certainty, or with absolute certainty, that claim is impossible to grasp. And so that's the idea here of our reason insisting on doubt. Anything can be doubted. Anything, you can just ask why, or why do you think that, or just ad nauseum, right? Until it's like, well, I just think so, or I just know, but that's no proper answer. So our reason insists on doubt, and our nature insists on certainty. So you can think about that, like you jump into your car and you don't think to yourself, like, okay, is my car going to start or not? What reasons do I have to think it's going to start? And how certain can I be of those reasons? You push the button and you drive. And you don't think to yourself, how do I know where I'm going? And am I intuiting this? Is this rational? Is it going to succeed this time? You just go, right? So nature is a dogmatist. That's his point. Well, reason, especially in our postmodern and modern age, reason insists on doubt and nature is still a dogmatist. So this conflict then, and here's the point, is within the human being himself. And so that feeds in, just so we're not losing the forest for the trees, that feeds into the wretchedness of man. That we have this conflict within ourselves of needing certainty, but also needing to not have certainty. Okay, let me see if there's a microphone. There we go.
My husband and I were commenting on this just the other day. The famous question of every three-year-old, so it begins within us at a very young age, mm-hmm. is why, why, why? Mm-hmm. They're always running around, and you're dealing in the world, and that little child is always, why? Mm-hmm. And that's that conflict there. Somehow it's already born. I mean, nobody taught them to be a skeptic or a reasonist, mm-hmm. but they want to know why. And so they're struggling right away with understanding the world around them. Mm-hmm. And that's like, mm-hmm. I mean, as soon as they have language, a two-year-old, why?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Because I said so.
Because I said that's right. Yeah, and you wonder if that innate curiosity tethered to God isn't this beautiful impulse to know him ever more fully and infinitely receive his revelation. But on account of the fall and unhinged from God, it becomes the very root of our uncertainty about everything. And it becomes this kind of spiraling abyss of doubt, which is, I mean, makes sense, doesn't it? Just the language, that the opposite of that would be faith. So if you've breached with God in faith, like don't eat of this tree, if you do, you're going to die, that demands and requires faith. And if you reject that, then you would spiral into doubt, which is exactly what we're analyzing here with Pascal and Kraft. Okay, so bottom paragraph of 112, just to get through this last note, The point, the lesson now follows, both nature and reason must learn faith, silence, humility, listening to God. Without this, there is no fulfillment of our reason or our nature, and no solution to the dilemma between them. Okay, so I like what he's done because he's shown that, like, the dogmatist, the one who's trying to find absolute certainty in the world, especially, like, absolute certainty apart from God, that's doomed to fail. Skepticism is, in many respects, superior because it can always pop that the way the pin pops a balloon. But skepticism doesn't land you in any satisfying place either. Skepticism is just a perpetual spiral into kind of deeper insanity. And then also a betrayal of your own nature. Like we said, the more of a skeptic you are in your mind, the more you betray yourself when you just walk over to your closet and put on your clothes and walk downstairs and open your fridge and just you operate as if all of these things were certainties when your whole mind is bent on showing that there's no such thing. All right, so big frame, wretchedness of man. Smaller frame, the wretchedness of reason, fallen reason, and smaller still, and to make another distinction, would be this idea of skepticism and dogmatism and this internal conflict we have. All right, let's jump back into the Ponce proper. I think that puts us at 109, doesn't it? First full paragraph there. Yeah. You cannot be a skeptic without stifling nature. You cannot be a dogmatist without turning your back on reason. Know then, proud man, what a paradox you are to yourself. Be humble, impotent reason. And so, I mean, this isn't self-contradictory because the assertion would be that reason itself tells you it's reasonable for reason to have limitations, right? So it is reasonable to us to believe that reason has limitations. Reason itself demonstrates this to you. So be humble, impotent reason. Be silent, feeble nature. And so that hasn't been explored with as much depth, but the idea of feeble nature, just this absolute certitude, which of course, as it expands, becomes an idolatrous kind of certitude and can take on any number of forms. Oh, the sun's been rising and setting for who knows how many aeons. It'll keep rising and setting for who knows how many aeons. That would be one example of this kind of false certainty, this dogmatism. Okay, so be silent. Yes, please.
I'm wondering if it's somewhat parallel to free will. When talking of free will, you say we have free will over those things beneath us, but not those above us, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Would our certainty or our dogmatism be much the same? We have no way of being certain, maybe, of the things that are above us, mm-hmm. the things below us, to a point, yes. But just like with free will, even the things beneath us, there's an opportunity we're wrong about that. But we have the ability to have more certainty with that, perhaps, aside from revelation and faith, of course. I'm just talking purely from human the standpoint of reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I can see your point. I guess I'd have to think about how that interacts with the distinction he's working with, right? And maybe you're not interacting with that at all. But you know, his distinction is as reason per se defaulting to skepticism, because skepticism has. I mean, it's kind of amazing even at this early stage, because I think it's even more so true now that skepticism is the dominant, like, rational conclusion. No one has or probably will be able to work their way out of modern skepticism and the epistemic implications of that. But even and the more you become aware of that, you just realize the contrast within yourself with nature, right? Who just acts as if all these things are granted and certain, betraying the higher order of the mind that knows there's no reason to believe they're that certain. So If that's the paradigm he's working with, as you're thinking about like things above and things below, is that interacting with that category or paradigm, or is it doing something different?
Well, I think so, and maybe I'm off base, but we can be pretty certain about the things that we can interact with.
Okay.
Now, what their true nature is, how they came to be, all of those things, we don't really know, because that's all above us, right?
Okay.
So I'm saying, analogous to free will, there are some things that we do control, mm-hmm. even though even the best laid plans, you know, don't guarantee mm-hmm. that the outcomes will be that which we desired.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I guess I'm just trying to say maybe there's two types of certainty or two types of uncertainty, skepticism, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's fair. That's fair that we can distinguish between like kinds of certainties, like even if we recognize that they're all almost like islands. There, we can be certain it's there, that there's a kind of phenomenon, but we can't be certain what lies underneath it, you know. It's floating there, as it were. That's what I mean by an island. I guess it's a bad example, but it's floating on the surface, as it were, and you don't have any way of knowing what's underneath it. But there is a phenomena there.
You know? Right, and so I think maybe an apologetic for truth would be different in those two ways of thinking of certainty. So I can argue, according to reason, that this cup of coffee is hot, and we could demonstrate that and measure that and come to some conclusion about that. But maybe that type of argument or isn't going to be as useful when we're arguing about things above or things that are certain in a different way, and certain only by the revelation.
Yeah, I think the elegance of what Pascal is doing, and of course Kreeft is wonderfully helpful, the elegance of it is the Christian would have a tendency to think in these terms. There are things that I know. There are things that I'm certain of. I'm certain of God, and therefore I'm certain of my sensory experience, and I'm certain of my reason, and this kind of thing. And the skeptic comes and it is able to completely undermine that with very little effort at all, right? And I mean, I had this kind of similar experience somewhere in early undergrad, where like I was kind of a dogmatist about, you know, the things that I held to be true or believe, and I was completely ripe, just like everyone else in the philosophy 101 class, for the atheistic professor to come in and just be a very basic skeptic and poke a hole in all of it. And the impulse is to fight back on dogmatist grounds, to try to leverage Descartes or whoever else you can in order to posit some sort of epistemological theory of certainty. The elegance of this system, and or I don't know if it's a system, but the insight of Pascal and Kreeft, is that both of those are equally wrong. And that you the narrow dogmatism is in some respects less helpful even than the skepticism. And where that becomes extremely obvious is when you turn to the atheist or the materialist. Because that same skepticism that they just leveled against your dogmatism of Christianity completely obliterates their system of thought too. Well, like even more easily. So you leverage that tool by abandoning both the dogmatism, and you're going to ultimately abandon the skepticism, but first you abandon the dogmatism, you take the skepticism, it's a wrecking ball to everything, and that's the point, and then it creates that silence. And it's that silence into which then God speaks, and you have the necessity of something outside of reason, external.
And that's your ground, and that's your argument. And then even if your argument is relatively soft, that the existence of God is necessary in order for us to even have our bearings on anything, thus it has higher explanatory power than anything else. And then you can contrast, well, which God? And you can say the explanatory power of the Christian revelation is greater in any, but now you're just in comparative religions, which is easier to do than just, hey, let's try to defend God and from scratch, and let's try to derive the Trinity or something like this. You don't, I mean, all of that's a mistake. So you get it into where the only way the silence can be answered is with God, and then a comparative study of explanatory power shows Christianity is vastly superior. So that's just one move, but that's the elegance of this kind of system, or at least critique that Pascal and Kraft are making over and against dogmatism and skepticism.
Pastor.
Yes, sir.
So in going back to your example when you were a young college student, is what's lacking there is the humility that this is talking about. Mm-hmm. Is that, would that be true?
Yeah, I mean, you don't realize it at the time, but yes, if you could, so the metaphysical implication of saying that I, in and of myself, like in a Cartesian way, can come to know absolute certainty that's completely self-referential.
Yeah.
At that level, I'm making myself God.
Yeah.
And that's why, I mean, it's hidden to us very frequently, but if you really follow the logic, that's what you're doing. And that's why, like, it's skepticism is a helpful enemy. It's right. A helpful wrecking ball, because it destroys that idolatry and idolatrous process.
But you don't even see it until you're looking back 20 years or 30 years.
Yeah, right.
You don't even see it at the time. That's
the problem with philosophy and theology and math, is we're never mature enough for it.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Yeah, but that's also the greatness of it, because it shows that the more we mature, and I'm thinking here along the lines of St. Paul, that the inner man is renewed day by day and is constantly growing and conforming to the image of God. We're constantly maturing, and we're constantly becoming able and capable of grasping things we couldn't previously. And that's really our unique design as human beings, to do that eternally by virtue of the incarnation and by virtue of our humanity being assumed into the divinity of Christ. That opens the door for us to have perpetual growth and maturation, wherein we're able to grasp increasingly difficult truths, concepts, experiences, whatever you want to say. Okay. Let's see, I kind of lost track here. Did we do commentary? Would be commentary on J? I don't think we did. Oh, did we not? Know then, proud man. Know then, proud man, what a paradox you are to yourself. Be humble, impotent reason. Be silent, feeble nature. Learn that man infinitely transcends man. Hear from your master your true condition, which is unknown to you. Listen to God. That's the punchline of the whole thing. Okay, so let's just jump over and let's grab, we'll go a little bit ahead of ourselves here. Page 113, J. The most important step in the whole apologetic strategy is this. Good apologists are not teachers, but pointers to the teacher. Unless they can get their listeners to listen to God, it will do no good at all to get their listeners to listen to them. And if they do get them to listen to God, it will soon be unnecessary to get them to listen to them anymore. So in either case, they are disposable, like tissues, once they have done their work. Listen to God, perhaps the three most important words in the whole book. Right, and that's the whole point of this whole book, and the whole point of Pascal's apologetic approach to modern pagans. All right, let's just hit K and L. So
we can go a little further. This is a tight, valid syllogism. If man had never been uncorrupted, he would have no idea or desire or memory of perfect truth or bliss. The unhappy prince principle that we've seen. Okay. But man does have an idea and desire, and it seems a memory of perfect truth and bliss. Therefore, man has once been uncorrupted. Or you could even argue like less temporally, but that shows then a substance in man that knows itself and knows what its experience ought to be, but recognizes that it's fallen short of that, right? So you would have, like, that would fit very well with the Lutheran way of thinking of the essence of man being God's good creature and the accidental qualities being the sin that have infected that good creature, that, or St. Paul's inner man, outer man. Here is a logical and empirical evidence for the fall of the distinctive Christian claim in anthropology that man's present state is abnormal, not normal. Okay, so this is like where we're starting to get into the explanatory power of Christianity, like in the details of this vanity of dogmatism and vanity of skepticism. You start to see that even the hungering or the belief that that truth should be attainable and the hungering for it is itself not only a kind of proof for God and necessitates God, but it also indicates a doctrine of original sin. So, like, theology and anthropology are always two sides of the same coin. And that's why as we're seeing the necessity of God, we're seeing that by virtue of our lack. And so in realizing the necessity of God, we realize the fallen nature of ourselves. Okay. Let's jump over to the Ponce again, and let's just pick back up right after those words, "Listen to God," on page 109. "Is it not as clear as day that man's condition is dual? The point is that if man had never been corrupted, he would, in his innocence, confidently enjoy both truth and felicity. And if man had never been anything but corrupt, he would have no idea either of truth or bliss. But unhappy as we are, and we should be less so if there were no element of greatness in our condition, we have an idea of happiness, but we cannot attain it. We perceive an image of the truth and possess nothing but falsehood, being equally incapable of absolute ignorance and certain knowledge. So obvious is it that we once enjoyed a degree of perfection from which we have unhappily fallen. Let us then conceive that man's condition is dual. Let us conceive that man infinitely transcends man, and that without the aid of faith, he would remain inconceivable to himself. For who cannot see that unless we realize the duality of human nature, we remain invincibly ignorant of the truth about ourselves? It is, however, an astounding thing that the mystery furthest from our ken, that of the transmission of sin, should be something without which we can have no knowledge of ourselves." All right. I mean, probably self-evident enough, but let's go grab Crafe's commentary here, and then we're finally to the end of this long Ponce. So, picking back up on page 113, the data is we are unhappy. If we had no idea of happiness, we would not feel unhappy.
For we would have no standard with which to measure our present state and call it lacking. So again, this is a refutation of a materialistic worldview, an evolutionary worldview. We're like, why on earth would you be, if we're just like slightly less hairy apes running around on a globe, why would we think there's such a thing as transcendent justice? And why would we be conflicted when we see the government of other hairless apes being wicked and letting us down and not ruling with justice and governing with righteousness? We all feel that, we're irritated by it, we have a sense that it's not right. But if we're all just hairless apes running around getting what we can get, why do we think that there's this overarching principle of justice? I mean, any other example could be used. Why do I have an expectation that I should be happy? Why do I have an expectation that my body shouldn't ache and groan as I get older? Why do I have an expectation that I should live forever? Or that any kind of chronic disease that attacks me is somehow some sort of attack on my very being and soul? You take it personally. Why? And you have to wrestle through that. Why? It doesn't make any sense. I mean, if we're just all apes and this is all just natural and there's nothing higher, then we wouldn't have all this conflict. We'd just be running around. I mean, I understand it's apples and oranges, but in the same sense, like your pet dog isn't sitting there wondering, you know, like, and your pet dog isn't miserable about the order of politics or the fact that, you know, I mean, he'll happily eat his food until you introduce a better food. And then he'll happily eat that and won't go back to the old. But he isn't sitting there pining, going, I know there's some absolute food out there that the master is withholding from me. So even as I eat this food, I'm going to be miserable. Right? So there's this sense in which we all know things we shouldn't know. And we all are miserable in a way that we shouldn't be miserable. Unless, of course, we are created and fallen from that created state.
I think you could even argue that reason would tell us that we should ache and that we should experience these things, right? We shouldn't expect something that's beyond ourselves, which is so interesting to me because I think it's so intuitive to, as humans specifically, to look beyond ourselves and to look for something greater than ourselves. In a way to almost see that happiness. Is that something that God has just instilled us specifically with? Is that what makes us human? Is that the image that we were created in? Or what makes us that way?
I mean, that's not quite the way... That thought's worth entertaining on its own, but it's just not quite the way that Pascal and Kraft are thinking about it. They're thinking that this is an artifact of the fall.
That makes sense.
Right. So it would be a separate question to say, does God create Adam and Eve, though they're in a state of innocence, does he create them with certain higher longings? Right.
Maybe the... Okay, so then the longings would be a result of the difference in our created nature versus our current one. Like the way that God intended us to be versus the way that we have fallen.
Yeah, I think that's the way that Kraft and
that makes sense.
Pascal are arguing in that second category. I mean, it's an interesting theological question in a different way. In what sense did Adam and Eve, even though everything they had was good, still long for more? And to what sense did God write that within them? It seems to exist, and it seems to be very likely because God made them good and not perfect. And the theology of 1 Corinthians 15 is that they were earthly, they were destined to be spiritual. The longing may even be that like good gift of longing for more, being a seed of a tree rather than the full-grown tree might be the very thing that Satan leveraged to get Eve to hurry the process, right? I mean, that's one of the possibilities, especially when you look at the telos of humanity, that God does in fact make us to be small g gods with him. I mean, that, like, this is what's... I know that if that sounds scandalous, it's just because we're not familiar with the language. If we are children of God, what are the children of a moose? Yeah, what are the children of a platypus? Yeah, I mean, right? It's so when God says like that in baptism we are born of him, born from above, that we become his children. We are becoming sons of God, or small g gods. We are becoming his offspring. Okay, so if that's what the telos is, then when the serpent comes along and says, "Eat this and you'll be like him," the impulse itself isn't necessarily wrong. Nor does God necessarily begrudge that, since he ends up giving it to us in the end. But the immediate gratification of that and in obedience to the devil is precisely the problem. There's a parallel in the temptation of Jesus. Bow down and worship me, and all the kingdoms of the earth will be yours. Well, Jesus has precisely come to claim all the kingdoms of the earth. So you hear this mispreached when they go, "Oh, look, Jesus eschewed all earthly power." No, he doesn't. By the end of his ministry, he's saying, "All authority in heaven and earth have been given to me. Go to all the nations and make disciples." Okay, so no, it's not that he isn't pursuing the kingdoms of the world. He is. But how does the devil offer that?
Quick way out.
No cross. Right? Instant gratification. And all you have to do is obey me. It's the same thing he did to Eve. So the idea that it's a fascinating idea that he's really not playing on like, you should desire this thing that you cannot have. That doesn't seem to be the temptation at all. Like, Jesus, you should desire the kingdoms, but you can't have them. That isn't the temptation. The temptation is you can have them all my way without a cross, which is better than your father's way. And then the parallel would be to Eve. You can become like God my way without any long-term growth or anything else. You can do it instantaneously and by worshiping me. The worshiping me part is the lie and the way he takes over and reigns and according to cosmic law submits everything underneath himself. Okay, little digression there, but it was fun. Yes, sir.
Yeah, some of the happiness, unhappiness is, you know, a question of nature versus nurture. And every year they do a survey on what are the happiest countries on earth. And every year the top ones are the Scandinavian countries, and the U.S. is way down the list. And that's not because they have a lot. It's because they are satisfied with what they have. So if we were better taught to be satisfied with what we have, we would be happier. I mean, everybody here has to have an e-bike. Everybody in Scandinavia has a bike. I've been there. I saw it. But they're all pedal bikes.
Yeah.
Almost nobody has e-bikes.
Yeah.
So, yeah. That you inherit your bike a lot of times.
Yeah. Yeah, in many respects. I mean, I think Crafe will do some more diagnosis on that particular, maybe I should hold off, because I think a big part of his book coming up is going to address that stuff. But just this idea that for the pursuit of money and stuff, we've ended up selling the things that really make, or trading in the things that really make us happy, which is like really family, community, husband and wife, parents and children, grandparents and extended family, cohesive society. It's an incredible thing, because I can remember just looking at like growing up in a place that was relatively culturally homogenous, and it's like you all have shared values and shared principles, and you just like there's so much in common. To the degree that you've lost that, it's completely disjointed. You can't assume anything, and you don't know if somebody's going to take out a machete and hit you, or if someone even speaks your language, or if someone even knows what you're talking about or values what you're talking about, or you just have no idea. So, I'll just be done there. Some of these countries that boast the highest happiness also have the highest homogeny and the least
departure from traditional family structure, communal, extended family structure, communal structures. Like humans are, we are members of a complex organism called, you know, the human grouping of people in whatever place, which the Bible has different names for, whether you want to call it a clan or a tribe or a nation. That's what the Bible values, that and knows that it exists and gives it those labels. When we deny all that, and then we deny it all often for the sake of better financial gain, and then we just go, why are we miserable? We've sold it all. Yeah, please.
So I think a lot of us grew up thinking Eden is perfect, Adam and Eve are perfect, God created them perfect.
Yeah.
But in this order, it would seem that they were made, I feel bad saying this, but they were made corruptible because they were corrupted.
Yeah, exactly.
And so they weren't made perfect.
Right.
Because if they were perfect, they wouldn't have been corrupted.
Yeah. I mean, they were certainly made good. That's the language of Scripture. But good doesn't mean like that they were made in a state of full maturity. So there's, I mean, Luther has this. I think Augustine has this. Irenaeus has this. It used to just be the entire frame of the West, as best as I can tell. And I don't quite know where we lost it sometime after the Enlightenment. But just this idea, I mean... Like the modern church just has this idea like Adam and Eve were in this state of perfection and it was their goal to be there forever and that was the goal. And then we fell from that and now we're just trying to get back to that. Well, Paul in 1 Corinthians 15, as I mentioned earlier, has a completely different view than that. We're not trying to get back to the natural man and the natural perfection. We're trying to get, in one sense, we're restored to that in Christ, but that means we're placed on a trajectory to go from the imperfect to the perfect, from the immature to the mature, from the natural to the spiritual. Because how do you explain the transition from a natural body to a spiritual body? So, I mean, all of this has its root and origin in the worldview of St. Paul, but then you just find it in the West, I mean, in the Church Fathers, but I've found it especially in the West. And that idea really then causes you to see that Adam and Eve paradoxically are in a state that is much higher. They're much more wise. They're much more happy and healthy of sound soul and mind and body than we are, which blows the evolutionary narrative. But the paradoxical side of that is that as much as they are greater and more blessed than we are in our fallen state, we in our fully redeemed state at the end of the age are going to be that much greater than Adam and Eve were in the garden. And they with us, along with all Christians. Yeah. Okay, any other thoughts? All right, let's see if we can press forward here. So, just on 113, I would think we left off in that paragraph M, data, we are unhappy. If we had no idea of happiness, we would not feel unhappy, for we would have no standard with which to measure our present state and call it lacking. Only Christian, quote-unquote, abnormalism, only the fall, explains these two primal truths, that we are unhappy and ignorant, and that we long to be happy and certain. So again, if you're paying attention to the nature of this apologetic, it's that it has that the Christian religion has explanatory power for the things we experience. So it's like you've diagnosed this in yourself and in the modern pagan, and then what worldview explains why this is the case? Because as I mentioned, evolution doesn't explain it very sufficiently. Why this is the case. But Christianity says, this is the core of our message, this is the core of our world history, this is the core of our theology, is that we fell and thus we have this dual nature or this conflict within ourselves. So Christianity has greater explanatory power than other religions or pseudo-religions. Okay, so last paragraph on 113. We cannot stop demanding our two foods, happiness and certainty. Nor can we attain them, which is so great. While we're constantly seeking and never satisfied, and we're constantly learning but never attaining wisdom. That one hurts. Yeah. They are the only two innate desires that are never satisfied. The only hungers for foods not found on earth and in time. So in other words, these are hungers for God, ultimately. All right, page 114, the top. And if you stare directly at the sun, you see a black spot. Yet only by the sun's light can you see everything else. Similarly, if you look at the dogmas of Christianity, especially the dogma of original sin, it seems dark and irrational. Yet only in light of this truth can we understand the whole existence. All right, and then in regard to his comments on instinct and reason. Wait, did we get there? No, this is the new Ponce. Yeah, this is the new Ponce and the last one of the chapter. 406, instinct, reason, we have an incapacity for proving anything which no amount of dogmatism can overcome. That's the first point. The second point, we have an idea of truth which no amount of skepticism can overcome. Okay, in the main, this week, last week, this whole time we've been on this chapter, it's largely been a meditation on that first point. We have an incapacity for proving anything, and no amount of dogmatism can overcome this. There's no way to find a certainty within ourselves that overcomes the skeptical attack. So we just spiral. It's an existential, epistemological spiral. And then this second point, we have an idea of truth which no amount of skepticism can overcome, is which is why we don't triumph in skepticism, where skepticism itself is a kind of, as soon as it's done eating the dogmatist, it eats itself, right? Because skepticism is premised like over and against whatever the concrete form of the dogmatism is. And then as soon as that's gone, it has nothing to attack but itself and its own premises. It is, after all, asserting a kind of truth, but it's a negative truth. And in itself, that's not justifiable. Okay, so we still have this idea of truth, which no amount of skepticism can overcome. So we're not satisfied with skepticism. We're not satisfied with the epistemological and existential spiral downward. And instead, we know there's this thing that is truth. We just don't know how to get it, and we can't get it within ourselves. Yes, sir.
Isn't this just Ecclesiastes 3? Also, he has put in eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end.
Yeah, perfect.
And so if that's the case, is this necessarily a result of the fall, or is this maybe not a feature and not a bug?
Yeah, well, and that was what I was trying to do with the two different questions with Micah's comment, because there are the way that Kraft and Pascal are arguing here is that it is a bug, and that bug is the fact that we know there's such a thing as truth, or we can't get rid of this idea or longing for truth, shows that we have fallen from something. So their whole argument is that it's a bug. That's the way they're thinking. Is there another way to consider that, though, in terms of, let's imagine there wasn't a fall, and let's imagine that you have a creator and a creature, and there's some gulf or separation there. Does that not create a kind of tension? And of course it does. And it's one that, had we not have fallen, that
attention would have still spurred us on in growth toward God and in maturation. It just wouldn't have struck us with any kind of curse. And so I think, like, you can make some key distinctions there that, like, the key difference would be if you think of God as objective truth, we as unfallen creatures have an image of that objective truth within ourselves. On the one hand, it's subjective because we are subjects, but it truly reflects that which is true. It is objective in that secondary sense. And so it becomes a matter not so much of accuracy as capacity, right? So you're right. You know what you know accurately enough, but you can always grow in that, even if that's a sharpening, right? So that growth is of a fundamentally different experiential nature than in the fallen state. In the fallen state, we perceive this as misery and consternation, right? And labor and toil and fruitlessness. I don't think Adam and Eve would have experienced it like that, right? Yeah. So I think your point's... well considered, that we want to think there are, and this is a broader way of thinking too, like this category is really important for thinking more broadly about the scriptural revelation. There is sometimes in scripture a gulf between God and man, and that gulf is innocent and natural and not overcomable, the gulf between a creator and a creature, right? The fundamental unknowability of God in a comprehensive sense, because if you could comprehend God, then he would cease to be God and you would be God, right? So there's that kind of gulf that is natural, and that's one distinction. But then the other distinction that we find in the scriptures is this gulf between God and man, because man is fallen. And sometimes those categories aren't clearly recognized, there's a muddle and a confusion and a dissatisfaction with the thought. Okay, let's just jump a little ways into the vanity of the philosophers, which is kind of hilarious since they're both philosophers, so you gotta love it. Top of 115, this point follows hard upon and is closely linked to the previous one about the vanity of dogmatism, for most philosophers are prime examples of just this vanity, notably Descartes, the guru of Pascal's age and of secular rationalist quote-unquote enlightenment, the new religion that has been Christianity's chief rival among quote-unquote educated people for the last 300 years. Well, one solution is we just got rid of educated people. Okay, Ponce 84, Descartes. In general terms, one must say, pointless, uncertain, and arduous. Even if it were true, we do not think that the whole of philosophy would be worth an hour's effort. All right, well, let's just dig in a little. We'll just spend our last minutes here with Kraft. The three things Descartes longs for the most, certainty, utility, and ease. His chief critique of the ancients was that they lacked certainty or a sufficient criterion. So some of you know the criterion problem. Certainty, in turn, was his means to the end of utility or efficiency, or, quote, the conquest of nature, end quote. This technological conquest, in turn, was a means to the relief of man's estate, that is, ease, comfort, and abolition of suffering. Yeah, so you have the whole modern utopia scheme that ran its way through, that the world wars largely proved false, and now communism and its lesser forms is trying to correct and redo. Yet these are precisely the three things his philosophy and the civilization that has been seduced by it not only fails to deliver, but destroys. Life has never been so full of confusion and uncertainty. So isn't that ironic that it's the pursuit of personal certainty that has led to the destruction of all certainty and to the utter confusion in which we've been plunged? Thanks for nothing, Descartes. Well, the Lord will judge him accurately. We don't need to. So, life has never been so full of confusion and uncertainty. The average person has never felt so weak and helpless. And all social indicators show we feel exactly the opposite of ease and comfort. This is proved both by the statistics on violence, rape, child abuse, incest, depression, and divorce, a form of violence, the suicide of the one flesh, and also by the plethora of peace of mind, how to cope self-help books we buy. I mean, would you say that things have gotten better or worse since he wrote these things these decades ago? So he's, just wild, isn't it? Pascal is a prophet. Descartes is a false prophet. And that's all the time we got, so why not? That's as good as it gets. We'll pick up next week, review this Ponce, and then go into the comment on B on page 116. Let's just look ahead a little ways. I know some of you enjoy these, some of you don't, but it looks like we have another colossal Ponce coming up, so we'll do the best we can. I don't think then we should... I would just say if you want to read ahead, just read ahead through that big Ponce, and then we'll go into that and get Crafe's commentary. So it'd just be like 116 to 126. The Lord be with you.